I know that that in revolutionary struggle and like battle, we have to recognize who's our allies and who's our enemies. In the U.S. Military, the bottom part of it is like, you know, their families are oppressed, and the only reason they went to like the army or whatever is because they don't got nothing else to do or nothing better to do. How do we get those people on our side? Because I mean, they're oppressed and, you know, exploited too.
Well, that's a question that touches on a lot of things of strategic importance, some of which I was trying to speak to earlier. Here's the contradiction. People come out of a very exploited and oppressed condition. And you know, one of the good things about that Michael Moore movie, the Fahrenheit 9/11, he shows how they go after and literally prey on people. You know, these military recruiters go after and prey on people who are, you know, in desperate or, you know, very difficult circumstances, and offer them this whole idea of the military giving them a way out. They can become musicians by going into the military, you know, and all this kind of stuff, you know. But there's a contradiction between, on the one hand, all those conditions that we're talking about, and on the other hand, when you get what happens when you get into the U.S. military and the effect it has on you and the effect it has on your family. Because the very strong pull is that your family wants you to survive, and it even wants you to prevail. And, you know, those two, they see those things as kind of being bound together. So it gets more complicated. And their initial reaction often against people, you could see that in terms of also that woman who's featured in the Michael Moore movie, the initial reaction is to be resentful toward people who protest against and resist the wars that their family members are fighting in. So we have to be able to deal with all the complexity of that as well. And from my experience, like I used to, you know, when I was back in Berkeley, we had what was called a Vietnam Day Committee that back in the 60s that protested the Vietnam War. And we used to argue with soldiers all the time who would come on leave from Vietnam or had finished a tour of duty and were leaving. And after a while, it was one of my favorite things, actually. They used to come seek us out to argue with us. And, you know, but the difference there, you know, and we were able to, you know, have a lot of influence on them by, you know, really getting it into with them and pointing out to them what was really going on. One of the differences between then and now is that that was what they call a conscript army. People were overwhelmingly drafted into it. Whereas now the draft, if you want to put it that way, is more indirect. It's more of an economic draft. You go in because, in effect, you're being drafted because, as you said, you have nothing better to do, or, you know, your life is not together and you're struggling, so you go in the military. But you're not literally drafted. Now, whether or not they're going to have to draft people again is a real question starting to come on the agenda. And that could be significant. They've already done a sort of an indirect draft by forcing people whose tours of duty or whose time in the military was supposed to be up to stay in and even stay in Iraq. And if that goes on a broader scale, and especially if they start bringing back a draft, that's going to change things a lot too. You know, because a drafted army is very different than a volunteer army, even if the volunteering is under economic compulsion. So what we're going to have to do is, it's going to be, or what's going to have to happen is going to be a combination of the development of objective things with the work that we do. In other words, during the Vietnam War, one of our main arguments, to be honest with the soldiers, or it wasn't our argument, but one of the main things going for us was they were having a fucking hard time winning. And when you run up against the reality that, you know, you can't win so quickly and easily as they tell you, then a lot of questions start coming up in your mind. And so that's one factor. You know, when they start running into a lot more difficulty than they've been told that they're going to run into, that opens them up more to being worked with. And we don't have to wait for that, but that's another factor that could be more favorable. But also you have to understand what goes on in the military that we have to deal with. If you read books on military training, like there's one called Making the Corps by a guy named Thomas Ricks, which is based on, you know, spending some time with the new recruits into the Marine Corps. And they literally tell you, I mean, this is a mentality. And, you know, I always feel you can tell a lot about an army by what it, or any body of people, by what they uphold as a model. and by what kind of relations they try to inspire people, if you want to use that term in this case, to fight for. And you read these training things, what they do is they say, your mama's not here anymore. This is a drill sergeant. I'm your mama now. And they try to entirely break you down so that you lose all, you know, individuality and all sense of what you were before you came in the Army, and then reconstruct you. See, we're always accused. I have to laugh at this. We're always accused of being the ones who do this, but this is what they do in the bourgeois military, actually. You know, they try to entirely break you down and then reconstruct you. And, you know, you'll hear them say things like, there's no I in team. So what they're trying to do is get people to identify with the group. Now, it's not an egalitarian group where everybody's equal. It's a very hierarchical group of command and command structure. But the idea is you're loyal to the group above yourself. And the reason they do this is because they cannot motivate people to fight these. Well, they try to, you know, do some stuff about freedom and stuff. That lasts about 2 days when you get into the real situation. The way they motivate people is by breaking down their identity as such and reconstituting it as part of this group too, and your only chance of survival and your, the only group that you care about are your fellow soldiers and your unit or whatever. So they're putting people through a mind fuck, to put it simply. And they're transforming the way people think about things. And a lot of people, including a lot of parents, go for this because they can see their kids out, you know, doing shit they don't like them doing. You know, they see them in getting into gangs or into drugs or just into trouble, you know, or hanging out, not doing much of anything without much future. And they figure the military will straighten them out. And then let's face it, there's the whole macho thing. You know, that especially, I mean, yes, there are women in the military, but the military, believe me, is still an extremely male supremacist, male-centered institution. You know, That was captured, ironically, in this movie. I don't know if anybody saw it. I forget the name of it, with Demi Moore, about when she was a recruit in the military. G.I. Jane. And the like the high point of the movie is that she goes, you know, this guy, this drill instructor, is trying to drive her out of the military. And she hangs tough, you know, and he's doing all this, the classical stuff they do. And finally, at one point, she turns to him, you know, when he's trying to get her to quit, and she says, suck my dick. Now, that kind of captures everything right there, you know. So this is the nature of the U.S. military. And so there's a lot of macho that goes into it as well, you know, and a lot of guys growing up in this society are susceptible to this. So partly this gets broken down by the work that we do, and partly it gets broken down by the reality of what they get thrown into, and particularly where it doesn't go very well. And then you start rethinking, you know, anything is like that. People have a system of belief. As long as it appears to hang together, they adhere to it. Because they've been trained in it, and their identity, especially in the military, is all bound up with it. But when things start not going the way they're supposed to go, and sort of the underlying assumptions that hold all that together start getting challenged, then there's even more basis for us to do work among them. And, you know, to appeal to them directly, look, you are not required to carry out orders which amount to crimes against humanity. You have a right to refuse to commit crimes against humanity. You have a right to refuse to carry out bloodbaths, whether in Iraq or here, when it comes down to that. So I think there is a lot of work that we can do and need to do. And there is a fundamental reality to what you're saying about where the people come from and their oppressed condition. But there are also these other factors in it that complicate it more. So we have to take all that into account.
Thanks. Yeah. I want to go back to the issues raised by that first question and talk about. I was heartened by the defense of dissent, and both in general, that is, in terms that would allow us to find positive things in someone like Mill, but also more concretely in the history of socialist revolutions, to say that when there hasn't been enough of that, things haven't gone well. For example, it might not have mattered so much that Stalin was trained in a seminary if some folks around who hadn't been so trained had been better able to speak and get their ideas articulated. The problem is, how do you translate that sort of commitment to dissent and the free expression with, you know, what seems to happen immediately after you seize power? In other words, I think you could measure the time between, you know, dissent and people talking and freely expressing themselves, the time it takes to go from there to reactionaries running around. You said you can't allow reactionaries to run around. The time it takes from go to one or the other, you can measure that, I think, in like milliseconds or nanoseconds or whatever the hell the smallest one of those is, in actual experience of revolutions, right? So what I sort of need to feel a little better about that defense of dissent is to know concretely in the history either of the Bolshevik Revolution in the 20s and 30s or the Chinese Revolution, your pick, whichever one, what it would have meant to have done better. In other words, you say we need to do better next time, but given that it seems to me in the history of revolutions, when people, it doesn't happen that people just begin to speak their minds and have ideas about how better to build socialism. If you let people speak, what you get are actually initial mobilizations for some kind of counter-revolution, and they're treated that way. And then the other contradiction you mentioned in your talk about, well, we've got this army around, well, then, of course, you have to end up using that army to handle this. That's what's happened in practice. And so what concretely would it have meant, either in the Soviet Union in the 20s and 30s or China in the Cultural Revolution, whatever, what do you think it would have meant to have handled that better? Because otherwise, I'm afraid, it seems to me that although I, you know, like I've said, I agree with that 100%, I can't in my mind imagine what that looks like. Because what happens is that in the context of revolution, ideas generated from outside the party typically end up being ideas that have to be dealt with as counter-revolutionary mobilizations down the road, right? It's not like you just say, how do we build socialism? It's like given the weight of tradition, the weight of the old society, those old ideas are always pushing us backwards. And eventually, the proletarian state has to show, has to treat them as such. So, you know, what would it have meant in either of those situations to have done things better, do you think?
Well, that's a very good question. I was hoping we were going to get some questions more directly related to the main themes of what I was talking about. No, it's not a criticism of the other questions. I was just hoping that we would also get some. Well, I think that one of the key things is to draw a distinction between ideas and actual organization to try to actually restore or overthrow the existing socialist state. There is a difference that should be drawn between people even expressing that the desirability of doing that and actually taking concrete steps to do it. And that difference should be expressed in a socialist society explicitly, and it should be spelled out in things like the constitution of that society. What is that difference? And if you say, if you're going to allow the expression of ideas, then yes, you have to allow, every idea isn't going to be not only in favor of the policies of the party at a given time, it's not even going to be in favor of the general direction or aims of the party and of the revolution. So you have to allow those things, the expression of those ideas in the society, you have to allow for constitutionally, as well as in other ways, encouraging the expression of those ideas and the thrashing out of those ideas. So one of the key things is to draw a distinction between the expression of ideas and active attempts at counter-revolution. And that should be spelled out in the law as well. There's a difference between saying we should not build socialism and blowing up a cement plant or, you know, a steel factory to try to prevent the building of socialism. There's a difference between saying we should protest the policy of the government and actually getting, you know, trying to do a beer hall putsch or something, you know, where you actually get arms and try to, you know, shoot the public security people or whatever in the society. Those are differences that can be drawn and should be drawn. And I think, you know, Mao actually, even before the Cultural Revolution in the 100 Flowers campaign, let 100 Flowers, you know, contend in the arts and 100 schools of thought and the sciences, tried to actually give expression to some of this. And exactly what you're referring to happened. The problem was that at first there were, you know, criticisms being brought out about the way they were going about things, and then there's a whole campaign of rightism developed where people said, just give up socialism and go back to capitalism. And, you know, that made it much more complicated. And after a certain period of time, they pulled in the reins and said, we can't have so much of that. So I think, you know, it is not easy. I think you are speaking very, you know, accurately to the contradictions you run into. You know, you never can absolutely – while I'm saying a distinction should be made, all distinctions in real life are not absolute. They're relative. There is not an absolute distinction between ideas and actions. So whenever people are expressing ideas, they're usually trying to encourage actions. You know, otherwise what's the point unless you just want to hear yourself talk? You know, and even people who like to do that still are usually trying to get somebody to take up their ideas. So I still think one of the ways in which we can and should do better is actually to more firmly and clearly draw that distinction and maintain it between people saying, well, you know, socialism no good, let's go back to capitalism, etc., and actually organizing an attempt to overthrow the existing system, which you do have to suppress, or else you're not serious and there's no point. But I think that you can and should struggle out in the realm of ideas the question of whether socialism or capitalism and ultimately, you know, capitalism or socialism and ultimately communism is better. And of course, the people who don't like socialism will prey on and take advantage of every error you make, every shortcoming, every way in which you can't provide right away what a lot of people had in the old society. But you have to, I think, struggle through that without using the organs of the state to suppress it because you're losing the argument. You know, that's where I think a lot of the rub comes in. Now, I do think, you know, even if you're losing the argument, you have to still keep going on the socialist road and try to win people over. But that's different than saying, okay, that's enough. I don't like this argument anymore because you're doing better than I am with people. You know, which isn't just because they have more cogent arguments, but they also have things going for them. This is what makes it complicated. There are a lot of things that make it easier to go back to capitalism. Because one of the things about socialism, you don't get to exploit the whole world. You know, a lot of what goes on, that was my point about the Sopranos, a lot of what goes on in this society is based on viciously exploiting little children and everything all in the millions all over the world. Now, all of a sudden, you're not going to do that anymore. So the standard of living may not be as high for a while, and people can play on that, especially, you know, people who are used to driving SUVs and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, it's going to be difficult. I'll try to be as honest as I can about this. It is going to be difficult to maintain this. And it's going to be difficult inside the party because, you know, the party, people who have sacrificed, given their lives for revolution, don't want to sit around a lot of time and listen to people talk about everything they fought for is a bunch of shit. So, you know, you have to train the party too, and not just train it one time, but to continue struggling within the ranks of the party about why this principle is important. Now, I'm not just talking about this now in order to, you know, try to lay out a general vision, which I am, but I'm also trying to create public opinion for this, even inside the ranks of the revolution. Because this is somewhat of a controversial idea. It isn't the traditional practice. There are elements of it that Mao tried to bring forward. In the Cultural Revolution, they had tremendous upheaval and expression of ideas. You know, that's one of the things that's often overlooked and distorted. I mean, they had people writing all kinds of stuff all over the place. And they tried to provide direction and guidelines. But still doing better would mean at least maintaining more clearly and firmly that distinction between the expression of ideas and the actual acts to destroy or sabotage or literally overthrow the state. That's a hard distinction to maintain, but we have to be – my point is to try to lead and train the people who are going to be the future ones running the new society to understand the distinction and to understand the importance of maintaining that distinction. And it's tough. Look, a lot of people, including people sitting in this room – have been, you know, gone through horrendous oppression and seen their families go through horrendous oppression in this society. And they've had themselves lorded over by people who were just a notch or two above them in the society, not even the ruling class. And there is a very natural tendency to just want to take revenge and not to want to listen to any shit from people who've been exploiting you all your life or have been benefiting from someone else exploiting you, even if not to the same degree. So this is a question of struggle. The people who are going to run the future society are not a handful of people. You have to have masses of people to solve these problems. The economic problems, the social transformations, the political transformations, and you have to bring forward wave after wave of people who raise their sights above just the question of revenge to see the question of the emancipation of humanity as a whole and the abolition of all relations of exploitation and oppression so nobody has to go through this anymore in the future. And that's what our party is all about, but that's a struggle. You know, I've just mentioned one dimension. Another dimension of it is you get people who haven't, you know, who join out of intellectual conviction, but who haven't really suffered that much directly. And a lot of times they will tend to waver at crucial turning points about whether you really need to fight through on things. And whether you can sort of compromise and go off the revolutionary road and accept something less than a thoroughgoing transformation. So there are all kinds of contradictions in a revolutionary movement and a party that have to be fought through. But it's people like the people who were here multiplied by thousands and tens of thousands who are going to be decisive in determining whether it goes one way or another. Not just leaders are crucial, but then there's the question what they lead people to do and what people take up or don't take up. You can't do without leadership, but you also are not going to solve these problems without masses of people, including, you know, especially the most brutally exploited and oppressed people who have to transform their own world outlook at the same time as they're transforming the world. I never believe in this thing of tailing after people just because they've been oppressed. Because that's just going to lead us back to the same thing we have in a slightly different form, if that. We should always be seeking to learn from the masses of people. But we also have to help people see the larger picture here. What is this about, and what are the methods and means that are going to get us there to a world that we all want to live in? Not a world where a few of us get a chance to get back at other people who've had it a little better than we have. And that's a point of struggle. Or not a world where those of us who had a little better want to stop the revolution as soon as it goes a little ways. So these are the real tough things. You know, I'm saying this in unity with the spirit of what you're raising, that it's a lot easier to talk about this than to do it. But the question is, are these principles getting understood and taken up by people who are going to be the future rulers of society? Nobody, no one or a few people run a society. People may lead, but no one or a few people can run any society, let alone a socialist society, let alone the one that's really going to emancipation for humanity. That takes thousands and millions and ultimately hundreds of millions and ultimately the large, you know, majority of humanity to do this. And so it's a struggle to enable people to grasp and to keep on learning more deeply ourselves. What are the principles and methods that get us where we need to go? To look beyond the momentary questions, even while we're dealing very concretely with the immediate problems we face, to always have our vision way beyond that. And then from that point, you can look back and see why it's important to draw this distinction. Why you should, as Mao said, you should toughen your skin when people are making criticisms. Even when, and I really believe this, even when people say things in the nastiest spirit, you should still let them speak because you can learn something. And they might be right. You know, I was talking about this whole thing about black holes and this whole thing where Stephen Hawking has just gone back, you know, and reversed himself on the question of whether black holes, which is this real dense matter that draws everything in, actually let anything escape and whether there's any information that can be learned. And for a long time he said no, and now he's reversed himself and said yes. Well, that's good science. That's a good methodology. You know, you're proven wrong, so you acknowledge it. Well, people who try to have a comprehensive approach to changing the whole world and try to embrace all these different spheres without suffocating them but learning from them should certainly not be poorer at science than someone like Stephen Hawking. We should have an orientation of going after the truth, of learning, and when we're wrong, admitting it and help everybody learn from our mistakes. We should have such a broad vision that we understand why it's important to maintain this distinction between actual counter-revolutionary activity and action and the expression of ideas, even of the most grotesque reactionary kind. And I think this is going to be something that, you know, I can answer this question the way I am, but this is going to be a point of extreme tension all the way through. And I think that the way we can do better is by being clearer and firmer about why it's important to draw this distinction. Because if you just say, let's draw the distinction, but people are not aware of why it's important, then they're not going to be able to maintain it when it gets really tough and when it gets really tricky. One of the most important things is to know what it is that you have to really put your foot down about and say, this is the way it has to be. And what are the times and things and circumstances where you really shouldn't do that? And if anybody's going to lead anything, they have to get better and better at being able to draw that distinction. If you think about it, you have to do that in everything that you do. Anybody does it in anything you do. You have to say, these are the things that really have to, I have to really get right. And these are the things that are not so important to get right.
Yeah, I got 5 kids, so.
Okay, so there you are, you know. You can't handle everything with the same intensity all the time. And this is the same, when you're trying to lead a society, this principle applies in a magnified way. You have to know what are the things you really have to insist on and what are the things it's better to let go and let a lot of ferment develop. So how well we do at training ourselves and at bringing forward increasing, you know, legions of people from among the masses who get this understanding and this methodology and this approach will really determine whether or not the kinds of things that you're raising get handled better or they don't.
Earlier you were talking about artists and scientists and how that wasn't really, or you haven't really thoroughly thought about it to fit in the agenda for a communist country, right? And I was just wondering if you have also thought about the whole issue of immigration, because in the U.S. is a big thing, I'm sure you're aware of that, and undocumented people, because sometimes we're not only poor people of color, but we are undocumented poor people of color.
Well, as our draft program points out, one of the first things we'll do is just remove this whole category of so-called illegal immigrants so that everyone who wishes to be a citizen in the new socialist society can immediately do so and obliterate, you know, that whole oppressive category of people who are forced into the shadows because they're declared to be, you know, illegal or unlawful or aliens or whatever. So that's one first step that has to be taken. Then there are, once again, you get complications because if you have your borders open, this is in certain ways is sort of similar to the last point that was being discussed. You have your borders open, you're going to get people coming in from other countries who are going to be counter-revolutionaries and who are going to specifically come to try to destroy your revolution. So you can't, at this stage, have just completely open borders that anybody who wants can come in. Plus, you know, you're trying to reconstitute your economy, and you do have to you can do that in a way that proceeds step by step. So one of the things we're going to handle correctly is that whole contradiction. The first thing that will happen that will be a big step is once this country is no longer a big force plundering and distorting and ruining other countries, and there won't be the same drive of people to have to leave their own countries. But still, as long as those countries are ruled by exploiters and oppressing classes, there's still going to be dislocation, suffering, and people are still going to want to come to or go to another place where they think they can have a better life. So we have to deal with that as well. How can we actually, you know, you want to have an orientation that this country you're building belongs to the whole international proletariat and to all the exploited and oppressed people in the world. That's the orientation that you have. On the other hand, you can't literally have all the exploited and oppressed people in the world come to your country, or you won't be able to maintain it. So there are going to have to be some kind of regulations about immigration, but first of all, immediately anyone who's here when the revolution gets made will become a citizen, and that whole category of illegal immigration will be eliminated in that way. Second of all, there are, and this goes back to the question about Mexico, there are a lot of questions about where the border is going to be. Because these borders are established by not only historical development in the abstract, but also through war and conquest and so on. So If you have revolutions in the U.S. and Mexico, exactly what part of now the U.S. is going to be part of the future country that comes out of a revolution here, and what's going to be part of what might come out of a revolution in Mexico is going to have to be decided concretely then. It's not going to be just exactly the same borders. So that's another fact that will have to be taken into account. Some of that territory may return to Mexico, especially if they're advancing further in their revolution, and it might be in the interest of the whole world struggle to have that territory go back to Mexico. That has to be determined concretely, but we can't proceed by these are the borders of the U.S., that's the end of the discussion. So that's another factor we're going to have to take into account. Then once we've consolidated whatever is this new state, it's not going to be called the United States of America anymore, whatever this new socialist state is called, whatever name is given to it, then it will have to have an immigration policy. Because, like I say, you can't just let anybody in, both because you can only take in so many people at a time in accordance with the state of your economy and the political conditions in the country and so on. And there are counter-revolutionaries whom much bullshit as they make about terrorists, there is a real thing that you're going to have enemies. Even the U.S. has enemies who want to do bad things to it, which is not surprising. I mean, a lot of what they do may not be justified, may not be what should be done, but it's not surprising. And a revolutionary state, a socialist country, will also have enemies that you have to try to keep out or prevent from doing, again, not an expression of ideas, but actual acts of sabotage and things like that, which cause devastation to people. Blowing up a bridge to cause a problem, blowing up a dam to cause a massive flood. You can't let people in who are intending to do that if you know that's what they're intending to do. But we have our basic orientation will be an internationalist orientation. That people from among the proletariat and the people of the world who are not the exploiters and oppressors and the active, organized counter-revolutionaries will be welcomed in this new country. And to the degree that people feel the need to come here, we will try to figure out the ways that they can be integrated in here. And whoever does come in will become part equally of this society and will fully take part in and be encouraged to more and more consciously take part in the whole process of transforming a society. There will not be any first-class and second-class citizens in this new society. That would go against everything that we're all about and would ruin what we're trying to bring into being. So there are a lot of these contradictions we have to work our way through depending on how things concretely go out. But those are some of the basic principles that would guide what we're doing. And we also have to overcome the discrimination that has existed where people come in as immigrants and they go into the lowest rungs with the hardest jobs and get stuck there. That has to be also overcome and transformed, that people who've been pushed into those positions, it goes back to the discussion earlier about overcoming these inequalities. Step by step, we have to overcome that too, so people are learning to do things in all different spheres and not just stuck in a particular and especially the hardest work with the lowest pay, most dangerous conditions, even though we need to transform all those conditions too so people are increasingly not working in dangerous conditions. So those are some of the principles we'll have to go into dealing with some of the complexity of what we'll actually face when a revolution actually... unfortunately, we're probably not going to get the whole two territory of the U.S. all at one time. Maybe we will. Maybe we'll get that in Mexico and a bunch of other things. Maybe it goes back to his point. But it's also possible that the revolution will succeed in, ripping away part of what's now the U.S., but not all of it, and then we'll have to consolidate for a time. So all those kind of things will complicate the picture, but the basic principles have to be along the lines of what I was saying.
I just wanted to ask you a question about what is your perspective about, the current situation that we have right now, seeing all the leftist movements going in separate ways now, like each one having their focus on something, and they just go through it. But there's no real unity among, leftist organizations or even, or wannabe leftist organizations. And there's a bunch of, reformist organizations or movements going through, and I don't see that much unity, in the movements going on. For example, I mean, there's, people struggling to fight for socialism, anarchism, and then there's, you know, religious people that have it, has a mindset to fight for their liberation of people. So how do you what is your perspective on actually, you know, combining those forces in order to work together in order to achieve a revolution and actually through the transition of capitalism to socialism through a revolution? In the meanwhile, in that transition, how does everything combine right there? I mean, is there going to be like a big chaotic, you know, environment in which everybody's going to be like following their own leaders, and then the Communist Party is going to, struggle to get their people together in order to run with the program that it's already set forth?
Well, I think the most important thing is to have a program and to work in such a way as to unite not the various groups on the left per se, but broad masses of people around a program that's actually in their interest and in which, even with a diversity of views, they can be united at a given time. One example of that was the whole work that was done in relation to the Iraq War by Not in Our Name, although there were other forces that did important work too. But they issued a statement. There was a statement of conscience signed by a lot of people. I'm sure you probably saw it back in 2002. And this actually enabled people with a broad diversity of views to unite around some basic principles while maintaining their diversity of views on many things. In other words, it identified some of the key things that people should be united around, like opposing this whole imperial design of the U.S. government to impose its rule throughout the world and to carry out heightened repression in the U.S. And it set down certain principles in relation to that. And then that part provided a broad framework within which people of many different views could unite. And this is part of what we call an overall approach of unity, struggle, unity. In other words, you seek to unite as many people as you can around things that are in the interests of actually moving things forward toward the goal of revolution, even if many of the people who unite don't necessarily come at it from that standpoint. But there are things around which they can seek a unity at a given time in terms of fighting various kinds of oppression that they all agree should be fought against. And this is how we try to approach it. That's the unity aspect. If you unite people broadly around a common goal or a common objective of struggle, for example, stopping the Iraq War, which you have millions of people can unite around that, even though you have many different views about how to do that and why this war is happening and what it's all part of and what is going to be required to keep wars from like this from continuing to happen. You have people who are pacifists, you have people who are revolutionary communists, and you have a lot of people in many different positions, but they can all unite around stopping the Iraq War, for example. So that's the unity. And then the ongoing process is one where you struggle over the differences, partly in order to make that unity deeper, but more strategically because this does need to go somewhere. And we need to struggle out what is the cause of this and what is the solution to it. And how are we actually going to uproot the things that we can all see are wrong in the society or outrageous in the society? That's the thing you struggle over with people. You don't have the same view of that. You don't see the problem in the same way, so you don't see the solution in the same way. You don't see the means and methods in the same way. You don't see the forms of struggle in the same way. But you share a broad objective or objectives. So you have unity around that and struggle around the things that you don't agree on while you're also carrying forward and developing the unity to a higher level. This can be a complicated process, but it's a very important one. And also, you know, people can come to learn that people can disagree and struggle and not have it turn into an antagonism. The more that people have a broader view of the world and of what's going on in the world and have a more fundamental sense of what's shaping things, the more they can see the way to carry out struggle without destroying the unity. So it's important that we continue, particularly from the point of view of those of us who see the world, you know, in the way that we do from a revolutionary communist perspective, to be bringing this forward fully to people. fundamentally because that is where things need to go, but also because the more that people see that broader picture, even if they don't agree with every aspect of it, it opens up bigger vistas for them and enables them to see how they can find their own level of unity with that, and also enables them to see how you can struggle these things out without having it disrupt the unity that's important to not only maintain but to develop. So this is a process how we see the unity struggle, unity going on now. Now, when you, in terms of getting to a revolution and what happens in the new society, the fact is, this is what I was trying to say with the example of the Russian Revolution, it will come to a point, whenever there's a revolution in this country, it will be at a point where the contradictions become sharply posed. Millions of people feel something is intolerable, not just in some abstract sense, but in a very immediate and pressing sense, they cannot go on with life while these things are happening. And they're willing to make the sacrifices to put an end to these things. And then they rally around that program that provides a way to solve that immediate and acutely posed contradiction. And in reality, there is only one program that can do that. And only one outlook that can guide that. Only one ideology that can lead in that. But that has to be shown in practice in the event when things come to that point. And when that happens, and these other programs are not able to provide the answer, then people will follow the revolutionary, the communist position. But the complication, which I was trying to speak to earlier, comes that then, when that immediate situation passes, and even though you've won, you've leaped forward into a new society, then all these other contradictions reemerge or reassert themselves in a stronger way. Everybody hasn't been fully won over to the program of the force that they see the need to unite around at the given crunch time. So then these other broader diversity of views reassert themselves. And that's why you have to maintain the unity struggle, unity, and the whole orientation of a united front led by the party of the proletariat and by the proletariat following the party's line in order to keep this going forward. So that's the complexity of how this happens. And the way that you unite the left, quote-unquote, is by providing the means, developing the programs and forms of struggle that can unite masses of people broadly. And then, frankly, people find their position in relation to that. If we seek to go out and unite all the left first, and as the fundamental thing, all we'll do is end up in squabbles, arguing about the things that divide us. What we have to do is develop the program and the forms of struggle that can bring forward masses of people, and in that context, struggle to unite people who have different positions or different groups within the left, broadly speaking. That's the framework and context within which that can happen.
Given the political climate today in this country and where it looks like it's heading, is there anything we can learn from, say, what happened with the German Communist Party when it was crushed in Indonesia, and how do we protect this party and its leadership while building towards revolution?
Yeah, well, that's a very urgently posed question, and I'm glad you raised it. Fundamentally, the protection of the party and of its leadership lies in, you know, bringing forward increasing numbers of the masses of people who understand the importance of doing that and feel that they have a stake in that. So that's the fundamental thing. However, it's not so simple as that, because as you're moving to do that, the enemy is also recognizing that you're moving to do that and is therefore impelled to try to crush you more quickly. So in a certain sense, it's a very acute, we could say it's kind of an acutely posed race against time here. This is one dimension of it. We have to bring forward broader and broader ranks of people who on various levels, but especially a core of people who really understand and are one to this whole revolutionary vision, and then more broadly around them others who, while they may not be completely one to that, see the importance of this party and this voice being out there and this being a part of the political terrain, and are willing to defend it on that level. That's one thing. The other thing is, let's look very seriously at the situation, which I know you are, but I mean, we have to just think about, if you think about the fact that the canceling of the elections is part of the discourse now, and everything that implies, well, we have to take advantage as much as we can of the opportunity to do things like this and other things of an even more public nature. But we're also going to have to be urgently developing the means to be able to carry forward the struggle and even to combat repression while we're coming under much greater repression. And this is a very, you know, acutely posed and difficult contradiction. And part of it is winning an ideological battle against this whole idea. I mean, some of the anarchists, you know, say, well, you know, we're not going to hide what we're about. You know, this is a matter of principle with us. Part of their problem is they don't want there to be a state, so they act as if there isn't one. And when in reality, there is. And so you know, the idea that you don't want to hide anything from the state is not a good idea. But part is we also have to wage an ideological struggle where people, you know, the government says, if you're not doing anything wrong, then what do you have to hide and what do you have to fear from us intruding on you everywhere? Well, we have to understand and we have to win other people, not just a few people, thousands and millions of people ultimately, to understand that from their point of view, we are doing something very wrong. To oppose them politically. We're not terrorists, but to oppose them politically, even if you're not working toward a revolution at this point, to oppose them politically in any significant way is, from their point of view, very wrong and something they want to put a stop to. And they try to create the atmosphere for that in all kinds of ways, including mobilizing this right-wing social base so that it appears that it's not even the government's doing it, it's just the people speaking. You know, we have to develop a mentality that even when things that are seemingly small, like, you know, Linda Ronstadt goes to the Aladdin, in Las Vegas and gets lots of shit for even something like praising Michael Moore's movie, there should be a counteroffensive back against that. Now, that's a small thing. You know, the Michael Moore movie has got its shortcomings. We pointed out in our newspaper, but it's doing something very good and positive. It's contributing to the whole overall mix and resistance that we need. It shouldn't go down that even something small like that, what happened to Linda Ronstadt, happens without there being a massive organized counteroffensive of people supporting her in what she's doing, even though she's far from a revolutionary. That's part of our battle. And there has to be a, you know, tit for tat back and forth on that. And we have to develop the mentality and also the organization to be able to do things like that without revealing everything to the enemy. There's no good reason why they need to know mailing lists and who went to every meeting and who said what at different meetings. And we may have to learn how to have meetings in different ways if they start saying that political opposition to them is beyond the pale, which is not totally out of the question and may not be, I'm not saying is, but may not be very far down the road. So this is another dimension. We have to take this seriously. One of the things that happened in Nazi Germany was that once the shock of this, you know, Nazi coup happened, people settled into trying to go along. This happens also in any, you know, in countries like the Nazis occupied France and other countries. People originally were shocked, tried to get away, but then they settled in and adjusted and accommodated themselves to the new reality. We cannot allow this to happen, and we have to be working on that now, and we're way behind. We have to be doing it urgently. So both in terms of our party, but also the broader resistance, we have to be spreading it in an urgent kind of way, not in a panicky way, but in an urgent way. And the leading edge of the party and the party's leadership is very crucial to be put out there in a bold way and spread. There should be all kinds of networks of people who are watching this DVD, the talk I gave, who are reading The Revolutionary Worker, who in other ways are in organized circles relating to the party. And then much more broadly, there should be a resistance movement, which also is developing its maturity and its sophistication and learning and in how to deal with the increasing repression that's coming and anticipating it and not waiting for it to happen, because then you're helpless. If you don't prepare in advance and anticipate, there needs to be discussion and debate, not just among people here. It should be all over the place. They're talking about canceling the elections. How are we going to resist it? This needs to become popular discourse among broad numbers of people. Yes, over the internet and in all kinds of other ways. We need to create public opinion, and people need to be talking about these things instead of going along assuming that this continuum is going to just continue indefinitely. So these are some of the ways I think we look, all we can ask for and all we can achieve is a fighting chance. We have to put ourselves in the best position and then fight when the thing, when new sudden twists and turns come. There's no way that we can guarantee if we just do A, B, and C, we'll, you know, the we won't get our head cut off. We should understand decapitation of leadership is one of the main tactics of this ruling class. They do it all over the world, and they will do it here. And that has to be taken very seriously. But you can't defend yourself unless you do it with masses of people. Even with all the other things I've mentioned, you have to do it with masses of people, and we have to do it in a way that both brings forward broader masses of people and also takes into account, anticipates, and deals with what we're up against and what's coming.
We'll have a plethora of issues and questions to raise, but let me focus on something about which I'm not well informed. But what I have in mind is the high rates of unemployment and incarceration of youth in the ghettos and the barrios, you know, gangs and street people, many with health problems, many of which may be engaging in self-destructive behavior and may even have some antisocial tendencies. But how much, I mean, I think morally, the interests of the, what they call the lumpen proletariat should be given a high priority. How much thought has there been to the, you know, let's talk about dictatorship of the proletariat. How much thought has gone into the role of the lumpen proletariat? And has a position been adopted about the role that the lumpen proletariat would play?
Well, I think there's a distinction between, like, a hard... It's important to draw between a hardcore lumpen proletariat, which is dedicated to and deeply committed and immersed in a full-time a life of crime, and broader numbers of people who get drawn into crime in many different ways in order to try to survive, or they just get caught up in the culture of that and so on. Even with the former group, we see people go through transformations. You know, sometimes it happens in prison. Sometimes it happens in the swirl and upheaval of things going on in society more generally. For example, you know, in the context of the rebellion in 1992, one of the things that went on was this whole gang truce attempt, which was a very widespread attempt of people who'd been deeply into this to try to go somewhere else. And they didn't have, the real emancipating outlook of communism. And a lot of their stuff was, you know, geared toward trying to get businesses set up and, you know, to try to be able to work in a more traditional way in the economy rather than an illegal economy. But I think maybe not enough attention was paid or not enough notice was made of this very real attempt of people to put forward a pro. I mean, you know, sure, there was unevenness. Some people were more sincere than others and more committed than others. That's for sure. But there was a real attempt for people to break out of this. And the system would not allow them to do it. It just brushed aside all the program that they brought forward for jobs and businesses and things like that, because that isn't where this system is going. And it worked to actually undermine any attempts to create conditions in which a lot of this gang violence could be, if not totally eliminated, reduced to a significant degree. And then the grinding of the system draws people back into the same things and draws future generations into the same things. So my orientation and orientation of our party on this is to, first of all, draw a distinction from people who are hardcore and for a long time and deeply committed into crime as a way of life. You know, essentially like crime bosses almost, even if on a smaller scale than some of the big ones. And even some of them could be won over or won to friendly neutrality to the revolutionary movement as it develops. And we should have an orientation of seeking to do that to the maximum degree we can. But then there's whole layers of youth in the areas you're talking about who need to be developed into a force for revolution. And I happen to believe there's a tremendous potential for that to happen. It's not easy. There's a tremendous amount to overcome. There's the pull economically as well as culturally of a lot of the things that people have gone into and have taken hold in these neighborhoods. And there's organized structures to perpetuate this stuff. So this is going to be a big struggle. Where are these youth going to go? And I'm talking about youth, including very young kids, not just teenagers. But what is going to be the attractive force and the model that they're going to look to? Is it going to be the gangs, or is it going to be revolution? Not that we're in direct competition with the gangs in that kind of way, but which model, which road is going to be the thing that's going to be drawing and attracting them? That's a big challenge before us. Their path has already been well hewed and laid out for them by this system. You go down this road and you end up in jail or dead before you're 21 in a lot of cases. And even if you get through the jail, you've got the mark of a felon or whatever on you for the rest of your life. And there are young kids, 4 or 5 years old, that are already heading down that road because there's a pull of everything, the system, workings of the system, and also the way in which the prevailing things in a lot of these neighborhoods lead them. So we have to have a strategic orientation that these youth need to become fighters for the emancipation of humanity, fighters for revolution, and we have to struggle that out. Doesn't mean we're going, you know, we're trying to be, like I said, be in competition with the gangs. I think we have to understand why people get pulled into this. It's very easy, you know, to condemn it. And I know what you were saying was not intending to do that. I'm just saying it is very easy to condemn it. It's very easy. Oh, let me put it another way. It's very easy to see much and a whole lot that's wrong with it. But it's important to recognize what is the workings of the system. What are the workings of the system that are pulling people in this way? This is actually a tremendous condemnation of this system, that you have 2 million people in jail in this society, and you have many more millions who have no prospect of anything but this kind of a life, whether they end up in jail or not, and many of them will. This is a tremendous waste of great human potential. You know, beautiful little children that the system is working and seeking to turn into people who can only work against their own interests and do things which cause harm to people like them. This is a tremendous condemnation of a system that it is awash in tremendous wealth that it has plundered and exploited out of people not only here but all over the world. And yet, for so many of these youth, this is the only thing that it opens to them. And most of them, I was reading an interesting study by, I think it was William Junius Williams, or I'm not sure, but it was a study about how most of the people who were even into crime, this is written in the mid-90s, actually don't agree with the idea that crime is a good way of life. But the pull to that is reinforced by the fact that there isn't another way of life that they can take up that's going to lead anywhere, and that by the fact that so many other people are in the same situation that they're in all around them. This is a challenge for us. This is a gigantic challenge for us. It's not just a matter of showing up and saying, here's the revolutionary banner and everybody's going to flock to it. People have a great deal of experience to know that's not true. But it is the strategic orientation that we have to and are determined to persevere in. Because this is actually in the interest of these youth and of the masses of people of whom they're a part. Their interests don't lie in this. This is not a way of life that leads to anything that's worthwhile for people. People try to, you know, people and human beings are tremendously pliant and resilient. They will try to find some way to deal with their circumstances and make something out of them, even in the most horrendous circumstances. And even some of these youth, in a certain way, are making a statement as ill conceived as it is, and as much as it leads against their real interests, they're making a statement that to the world in a certain way that they're not going to be made invisible and crushed and count for nothing. And they're trying to actually find some way to create some meaning out of the conditions in which they've been cast and are held. And our orientation is that we have to provide them with the understanding and with the means and forms of struggle. And that's where it gets hard, but we have to keep working on this problem of how they can become part of a revolution to transform the whole world and not only provide a whole different life for themselves and people immediately around them, but for the people of the whole world. And this is a problem we're not going to solve with a few people. This problem needs to be put out to the masses of people. They need to take it up. People who are already inclined toward the revolution need to get together and put their heads together and thrash out, how do we win more people to this and away from this other stuff? And we have to put this problem, as more and more people are drawn forward, we have to draw them not only into the revolution in a general sense, but into the struggle to solve this problem on yet a bigger scale. What are the means and forms of struggle and of organization that can give expression to a whole different world outlook? And a whole different program and a whole different meaning to what your life is about. This is a problem that we're going to keep working on because strategically, I don't believe that these youth and the broader mass of people which they're a part are only capable of self-destructive or more generally destructive activity. I believe that they're capable of emancipating activity. And it's our responsibility, those of us who see where the world needs to go and understand the contradictions, it's our responsibility to keep working at this contradiction until we bring more and more of them forward and draw more and more of them into consciously wrestling with this contradiction.